Hello and welcome to another episode of Crazy Making. I'm Simon Adam, host of Crazy Making. Today, I speak to Sarah Redicott. Sarah is a MAD and lived experience activist, academic, and PhD candidate in the graduate program of Gender, Feminist, and Women's Studies at York University in Toronto, Canada. Sarah's research uses critical and feminist theory and methods to critique psychiatric knowledges about self-harm. Drawing on insights from MAD studies, queer and feminist affect theory, critical and feminist disability studies, and critical race theory, Sarah's scholarship engages directly with lived experience accounts to co-create relational, intersectional, and contextualized engagements with self-harm and to inform social justice outcomes in, quote, mental health research. At the heart of Sarah's work is a commitment to witnessing across difference and intervening into the pathologization of distress to inform social change. Sarah's work has been published in scholarly, community, and grassroots publishing venues, including Sociology of Health and Illness, the Canadian Journal of Disability Studies, and Canada Watch. Welcome, Sarah. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Thanks for appearing on the show. I've been really looking forward to talking to you because, in my view, I think your work is really, really important and also quite unique in the sense, in the context of critical psychiatry research. I don't think anybody who's talked to us about self-harm. So I'm really looking forward to today's interview with you and some of the insights you can shed. So given that, Sarah, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're up to currently in terms of your current academic work, your current research?
Yeah, so I am writing my dissertation right now. I'm in sort of the end stages of, you know, revising and wrapping up. And so my dissertation is a MAD lived experience engagement with self-harm. So it was really important to me coming into this project as someone with lived experience of self-harm that the voices and perspectives of, you know, people who actually practice this are the driving force behind the research. You know, so often self-harm, especially in psychiatric accounts of self-harm, is, you know, framed as something that's really perplexing or hard to understand or something very catastrophic. It needs to stop right now. And so I think my guiding ethic in my project is, you know, like, what happens if we take self-harm seriously as a way of being in the world, as a site of knowledge production and survival, and, you know, engage with it in ways that are, you know, maybe a bit more generous and lived experience attuned. You know, what happens when we approach it differently? So that's what I'm working on right now.
Self-harm is, in some ways, it's a pretty self-explanatory concept, but in other ways, especially when you complicate it and put it in the context of mental health, quote unquote, mental illness, becomes a lot more sort of nebulous, if you will. So are you able to just provide us with a bit of a definition, if you will, of what how you conceptualize self-harm, what it is, perhaps if you can maybe give us a couple of examples of self-harm.
Yes, thank you. I love this question. Just before this interview, I pre-read my first analysis chapter, which kind of unpacks this idea of what counts as self-harm, you know, what how we understand it. So in, you know, general kind of lay or public understandings, you know, typically when we think of self-harm, we think of self-cutting first, and things like self-burning, self-biting, you know, things that are directed towards the self that are immediate in their effects, of bruising or bleeding or pain. And I use the word self-harm because, interestingly enough, the word self-harm doesn't appear in the DSM. Psychiatry is increasingly turning towards the use of self-injury, so non-suicidal self-injury, to kind of describe practices that are, you know, intentional destruction of body tissue is how it tends to be described. And I like self-harm because I think it's, you know, a heuristic, like meaning that when we say self-harm, generally, you know, folks know like what that is, what it refers to. But some of my work is kind of unpacking how self-injury is described or defined in like very narrow ways that exclude broader practices of, you know, what could be understood as self-harm, disordered eating practices, overwork, overexercise, you know, risky sex or sex that you engage with the intention to cause harm to your body, mind. So self-harm tends to be described in like pretty narrow ways, and I'm interested in opening up the conversation, you know, to see what happens when we engage with maybe more diverse, more expansive understandings of what counts as self-harm or what falls under that umbrella.
Okay, thanks for that. I like that you've actually sort of resisted and deviated away from DSM framings of this concept. I don't know if that was intentional or if it was accidental. I could be overstepping here, but I do see that as an act of resistance, at least discursive resistance, that's for sure.
Yeah. Actually, so when I came into my, when I came into my research project, I was maybe a bit more invested in like having really clear cut definitions, because, you know, in terms of epidemiology or just like looking at rates of a certain phenomenon, like if a lot of the clinical and critical self-harm literature is really invested in, like if we have a very specific definition that is used across research contexts, so the same definition of self-injury in every country, then we can have a better clinical and epidemiological or like public health understanding of how self-harm or self-injury impacts populations. So I came into the study and I actually used the word self-injury because I was like, yeah, this makes sense. If we have a consistent definition, then, you know, we can maybe know more about it. And it wasn't really until I got into speaking with people about their lived experiences and noticed that even though I used self-injury in my recruitment materials, folks I was speaking with were using the word self-harm. And so it invited me to take a step back and think about maybe the politics of language and, you know, again, kind of centering the perspectives and of those with lived experience in these conversations. So that's how I came to self-harm. It was sort of a roundabout journey.
Interesting. And, you know, and while we're at that, talking about language, nomenclature, and selfishly, I have to ask you a question, because I've been kind of throwing the word self-mutilate around and occasionally use that to denote self-harm. So can I ask you, is that an acceptable term? Is there, what's up with the concept of self-mutilation? Just so I know whether or not I should be changing my language.
Yeah, I've been chewing on mutilate lately, like just chewing on the word. And I started thinking about maybe like mutilate could be, I don't know if useful is the right word, but like productive in some contexts, because I was reading Bonnie Burstrow's work, her 1992 text, I think is the year, Radical Feminist Theory. And she uses the word self-mutilation to talk about, to differentiate between self-harm by women that is done for survival under patriarchal violence or, you know, gender-based violence. And then the self-harm that all women do under patriarchy, but isn't pathologized. So hair removal, dieting, painful clothing and high heels and all these things. So Burstrow used self-mutilation to, I guess, sort of problematize how some things are pathologized and others are encouraged. So I've been chewing on mutilation lately. I think there's some folks, some perspectives that critique mutilate because it implies that, I think there's kind of a degree of you're ruining something when you use the word mutilate, you know, you're ruining the flesh, you're destroying your body or whatever. But I think in some, I don't know, I'm revisiting it. So I don't have I'm working through it.
Okay. That's kind of sort of where I ended up too with self-mutilate. My worry is that it frames ideas of sort of destruction to the body and the psyche, that it's a deformation. So that, and that could be framed negatively, of course, right? So when, you know, there are all sorts of ways, as you say, that self-harm can be productive. So let me ask you then, why do people self-harm?
This is a good question. And I don't, you know, I think people self-harm for lots of different reasons. And those are all very, not to individualize it or like make it a problem of individual people, because I think, you know, self-harm is, in my understanding, related to emotional distress and pain. And that pain and distress happens in social and political contexts. But I've spoken to people who self-harm, you know, as a way to get some feelings out. You know, you have a buildup of really intense anxiety or fear or anger, and it needs to come out of you somehow. And I've spoken to folks that self-harm is a kind of self-punishment, you know. I've spoken to folks who self-harm because they've experienced trauma. They are dissociating. They don't know if they're real or not. And some self-harm can help bring them back into their body in a way that is comforting. I've spoken to self-harm, to people who self-harm as a way to, you know, they've had their emotional pain invalidated, and sometimes putting it in conversation with your body makes it real, even if only to yourself. And you know, so there's not really, it's multiple, it's fluid, it's many things. And yeah, so in terms of why people self-harm, it's interesting too, because, well, maybe, no, I'll go for it. Like, the psychiatric literature talks a lot about function of self-harm. What's the function? What does it do? And that happens so that they can, you know, develop deeper clinical understandings and develop more effective treatments and such. And I think when we start to kind of hone in on the function, then, you know, what really happens in those conversations is that psychiatrists describe self-harm as a kind of maladaptive emotion regulation skill. So anyway, maybe I'm going off on a tangent, but
not at all.
Okay. Yeah. You know, it's a way that you're regulating your feeling, but it's maladaptive is a word that gets used a lot, perplexing. So it's interesting because, you know, in so much psychiatric lit and for so long, self-harm appeared in psychiatric text as a symptom of borderline personality disorder. And that was largely it. And now, you know, seeing sort of an expansion to recognize that, yeah, people self-harm, in order to cope with emotion, but that coping is pathological. So it's, yeah, it's very interesting. I've been thinking a lot lately about, anyway, self-harm and emotion. And then it's tricky because you don't want to universalize it either, but I'll wrap up that thought there.
Yeah. So I guess, which is kind of really the crux of your work, as I understand it, is the sort of, you're critiquing the pathologization of self-harm. You're critiquing the making of self-harm a problem in the psychiatric context and suggesting that there is a whole slew of reasons why people self-harm, that if we understand the historical and contextual and lived experience context, then we can see that these are actually expectable outcomes why people self-harm. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Then I'm going to, so let me ask you then, given that, and given all the work that you're doing in the critical psychiatry sort of sphere, if you had one major critique of psychiatry, or as I say, one bone to pick with psychiatry, what would it be?
You know, I think it might be more of a wishbone, because I have two, and I think they're connected. I think, first of all, the way that psychiatry frames distress as something that is apolitical or depoliticized, you know, how it comes to be framed and understood and treated as a problem of individual people's minds instead of, you know, something that is very intimately related to the worlds that we live in, the relationships that we have, our life histories, you know, our schooling and healthcare and employment and all these kinds of things. And then from that, maybe the even bigger one I have is the way that psychiatry becomes the only way of understanding distress, and that is as an individual medical problem. So in terms of depathologizing distress, you know, it's the only way that things like, I'm trying to find my words here. Yeah, I think it's that psychiatry becomes the only way of engaging with distress in a way that has any kind of legitimacy or meaning to people. So, you know, other kinds of frameworks for engaging with distress in ways that aren't attached to psychiatric illnesses or mental illnesses, they become really hard to imagine and hard to articulate. So things like, and then, yeah, so it, like, psychiatry becomes the only place for folks to go with their distress that is recognized as real. And then it's also so inaccessible. So then people are struggling and in need of caring response and engagement. But the way it's set up is that actually the only way that you can, you know, the legitimate way that you can have your distress responded to is to go to the emergency room or to get ambulatory care or see a doctor. And so then other possibilities are sort of snuffed out. And it just creates a really terrible circumstance where other kinds of care are really undermined and rendered impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, I can tell you for sure, having worked as a nurse in Emerge and been on the receiving end, I have seen a lot of people come in for the support that they don't end up getting, unfortunately, because the system is not really structured then and there to provide the kind of support that certain people need with their psychological and emotional distress and mental health needs. So been there.
Yeah, I increasingly my work is taking me to what responses to self-harm can look like in ways that are MAD-informed, in ways that are caring, in ways that maybe witness distress without immediately having to make it stop or go away. And that, you know, that question of response sort of inevitably leads you to the emergency room setting, because I think for so many folks, especially, you know, folks that can't afford private therapy with, you know, a psychotherapist or a clinical social worker or whatever, you end up at the emergency room. And then once you're there, you know, you really have to be actively suicidal in order to receive any care. I've spoken to so many folks who have gone to Emerge hoping for some kind of caring support, because that's where you go, you know, in the way things are sort of set up right now, only to be sent away after waiting a handful of hours because, you know, if you're not actively suicidal, then there's nothing that they can do to help you with. So yeah, that's sort of where that's the next chapter in the journey, I think.
Journey, yes, so to speak. You said that your research is kind of taking you in the direction of responses to self-harm. So this might be as preliminary, but are you able to tell us a little bit of, or tell us a little bit of the sorts of responses that are non-psychiatric that ought to be considered?
Yeah. So I got into the question of response because, you know, I was hearing from folks I was speaking with that there was just a real lack of, I've been using the word witnessing, which I think is kind of helpful, a lack of witnessing for their lived experiences of self-harm, you know, as, you know, as young people, I had, you know, participants kind of share stories about as young people, their parents finding out and a lot of anger, and fear and intense emotions, which really kind of shut down any sort of meaningful discussions or engagement with the feeling. And so I think there are a couple of alternative responses, but it's also, you know, in order to, it's tricky to articulate things that, no, never mind. I take that back. But in terms of responses that are maybe more supportive, I think it's a matter of like sitting with, it sounds so simple, but it's so radical, like sitting with it, you know, through my work on feminist crisis lines and feminist counseling, the like real power of holding space for pain without intervening anyway, because that's not always what's required. Intervention isn't always what's required. Sometimes it's a matter of letting it exist and letting it matter and letting it be intense and, you know, you're not alone. And also most folks who self-harm, you know, don't access formal supports. They speak to their friends, they go online, they speak with, you know, trusted supports. So I think really when we're talking about responding to self-harm, we're talking about connection and developing capacities to like sit with emotional pain or expressions of pain, or, you know, in ways that can appreciate, might not be the right word, but in ways that are really valuative and compassionate. Yeah.
I like the sit with idea. I know you say it's really quite simple, but quite radical at the same time. There's also, as you're talking, I'm thinking about discourses of risk and risk management and comfort with risk. There's also that needs to be centrally considered, right? For not necessarily those who self-harm, but maybe to some degree, but more so on the part of the supporter or the listener, if you will, and just kind of being a lot more comfortable with risk. As opposed to sort of stepping back and throwing your hands up and saying, oh no, this person's suicidal, call 911 type thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that insight, Sarah. I just, before I close, I want to ask you, all this work that you're doing, it's for a certain set of audience. Who is it that you're speaking to? Who is it that you want to hear or appreciate this work? And if you had a few closing remarks for those audiences, what would they be?
Yeah, my work is for and with people who self-harm. And that happens across the life course, across, you know, different kinds of groups, age groups, race, gender, like it's really just, there's no rules about who self-harms. But in terms of speaking to people who self-harm and with folks with lived experience of self-harm, I guess I'll say open my heart and like, you matter, you're important, your distress deserves to be taken seriously. And also like, Oh, I don't know. I don't know, Simon. Like the feeling.
Go for it. It sounds like there's an idea there that needs to come out.
You don't have to stop if you don't want to. You engaging with self-harm is something that deserves respect. And
That's awesome.
you.
Beautifully said. Thanks for engaging with me in your research, Sarah. And even just as importantly, thank you for providing some really candid, important, necessary, and sort of must be heard and engaged with ideas for people who struggle every day and deal with various problems and social problems in their lives and self-harm, partly as a result and partly as a result of other things. Thank you for appearing on the show, and I wish you the best in the completion of your dissertation, which I understand is very, very soon. And I will see you probably around campus at York University.
Wonderful. Thank you, Simon, for having me.
Thanks, Sarah. Sarah Redekop is a PhD candidate in the graduate program of Gender, Feminist, and Women's Studies at York University in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe and listen to us wherever you get your podcasts. Reach out to us by email at crazymaking@yorku.ca. That's crazymaking@yorku.ca. And follow us on Instagram at crazymakingpodcast. Thanks for listening.